As you said, my name is Rodrigo Zamas. Before I launch into my presentation here, I just wanted to thank the Digital Journalism Research Group for inviting me out here, for being wonderful hosts, and for some good discussions that we've already had and that I hope we will have over the course of this presentation. And I should also note that if you guys have questions at any point, feel free to just ask. Otherwise, we can just have a little Q&A towards the end. I will also note that I made these slides a lot wordier than I normally would. There's a lot more text on them, and that's precisely so you can download a copy of the slides and be able to remember what I was talking about at that point in time. And I also have a tendency to speak very fast because of my Brazilian background. So if you need me to slow down at any point, just say, you know, hey, Rodrigo, can you just repeat that, but a little slower, please? And I'd be happy to do that. So a little bit about me. I'm about to enter my fourth year at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, which is in the northeast part of the United States, where it's nice and cold and snowy. I'm originally from Brazil, lived in Miami, Florida, moved up to Minnesota, now Massachusetts, so just this northward migration, and now I find myself in Oslo. So, and my two primary areas of research look at how journalism is being reconfigured through the introduction of technologically oriented actors, actants, and activities. So as we see data journalism, for example, proliferate in journalism, as we see automation become more common in journalism, as we see techies, you know, software developers that were once seen as the help in the newsroom to fix someone's email, all of a sudden have far greater reputational cachet. You know, they're granted more power in newsrooms because they're seen as these people that can figure out the future of journalism in many ways and do things that journalists themselves feel unable to do. And my second main area of research focuses on methodological development. So that's writing computer code to try to look at news articles and extract, you know, who are the main actors in those articles, what are the dominant frames in those articles, and so on, and also develop techniques for automating content analysis by scraping information, you know, that kind of work. So those are my two main research areas. Just a few quick examples of my research. One was published in Journalism Studies, looking at how we can better scrape information from news organizations, and in particular, be sensitive to information that is constantly changing. So things that would use JavaScript, for example, that requires some level of interactivity, how we can capture that interactivity through computational scraping. Another article came out of my dissertation, which focused on the impact of web metrics, and in particular, the popularity of news items and the effect that would have on the placement of content on the homepage and whether content would stay on the homepage for longer periods of time if it was popular or not. So kind of that question of whether journalists are deferring more of their editorial decision-making to quantified information, to quantified measures. From there, I did kind of a synthesis of what we know in the field about quantification, about audience metrics in journalism. So this is more of a review article trying to summarize the field and set some questions up for future research. So you can see that I'm starting to move more from methods, theory, now to more conceptual work, more synthesis. And my most recent piece that's currently under review is an encyclopedia article looking at the use of algorithms in journalism. So this is a new area that I'm entering into now with algorithms and journalism, whereas before I had focused a lot of my time on audience metrics and audience analytics, now I'm transitioning to algorithms and automation. So in this presentation, I'm going to be raising more questions than I will answer, precisely because I would love to see how others are thinking about this and to see if there are potential avenues for collaboration with other people. So that's my research in a nutshell, and I'll start by defining the two main terms in the title of this presentation, the first one being algorithms. What are algorithms? And I'll start by noting that there's actually no single definition that is well agreed upon in the literature as to what constitutes an algorithm, but there are two sets of definitions. The first being technical definitions, the first set. The second set being more social definitions. So for technical definitions, they tend to focus on the material aspect of algorithms. So really the technical components of what, you know, like the code that would lead to an algorithm. And those definitions have been critiqued for being too technologically deterministic, which I think is a fair critique, and also overemphasizing the material aspect, just the code behind an algorithm. So an example of a technical definition, this comes from Latzer and colleagues. An algorithm is a finite series of precisely described rules or processes to solve a problem or accomplish a task, generally through a sequence of stages that transforms input through specified computational procedures called throughput into output. So this is the kind of definition that you would find in computer science. And this would be kind of an illustration of what that process would look like, right? You have some data. This is just an example for a public relevance algorithm, something that would determine whether you'd be interested in something or not. So it's taking some data from the user's request, from some of their previous activity. So that's going to be the input stage. The throughput is where the algorithm will do its work. So it'll do some selection. It'll have a separate algorithm to, or a separate component to figure out how likely it is that you'd be interested in that content. And from there, it will go ahead and spit out some results for you. So this is just a very simple, very essentialist, description of an algorithm. So you guys can get a sense of, how it's described in computer science. I'll also note that algorithms vary widely in complexity. You can have an algorithm that has very low complexity. So this could be something as simple as you have visited a page. What is the size of the screen that you're using to visit this page? Is it really small? Likely you're on a mobile device. So I'm going to redirect you to the mobile version of our homepage. Otherwise, if you're coming with a larger screen, I'm going to give you the full desktop version. It's a very simple, basic algorithm. You can have something that's a little bit more complex, and I'll show an actual tweet from this example, but this would just take information from a data set like the U.S. Geological Survey that will show if there's been an earthquake in the United States. Right? For every earthquake, it will have a log entry of when the earthquake happened, the magnitude of that earthquake, the location, and so on. And so this algorithm would be constantly looking for updates in that data set. The moment it finds a new entry, it will create a new tweet that will just say, here there was an earthquake of X magnitude close to this place. Here's a link to the Google map of where it happened. And in some cases, it might also write just a short blurb about it. But again, very simple because it's highly, highly structured information. Then you have very complex algorithms like Facebook's newsfeed that is taking all sorts of different input about, you know, people you have recently messaged through Messenger, people whose profile pages you've seen recently, the sorts of links that you've clicked on in the past. So it's taking a lot of different things and trying to bring it together to figure out what kinds of stories are you most likely to be interested in and want to engage with as you look down your newsfeed. Because, of course, Facebook just wants you to spend as much time as possible on their site. So those are the more technical ways of looking at algorithms. But then you also have the social, where it focuses on the process of social shaping in terms of the way that the designers of algorithms will imbue their own values and ideas into the algorithm as they create it, and how as the algorithms go into practice, how that in turn feeds back ideas to the creators and to those who use the algorithms or are affected by those algorithms. So Tarleton Gillespie has identified three such views, the first one being the algorithm as synecdoche, and here it's talking about the ill-defined network of all the players that are associated with that algorithm. So it might be the news organization that uses it, it might be the software developers that help to create the algorithms that are used by the news organization, then you might have some of the users, and you just have a whole range of people that are part of this network, so that you're not just looking at this one single material object, but you're looking at all the people that play a role in shaping that object and are affected by that object. You have algorithm as talisman, where you look at the values that become associated with algorithms. The example being that it's objective, right? That algorithms have this objectivity that makes them superior to human beings who are highly subjective, and thus algorithms can be more fair and rational in their applications of rules, which these are ideas that are highly problematic if you come from more of an STS background. And then you have the algorithm as commitment to procedure, where you are looking at the social phenomena that promotes taking social phenomena, social things, social facts, and trying to measure and quantify them in some way so that you can put it into a structured database. And also how people, the logics that are employed to develop the step-by-step interventions that will guide that process of transforming social phenomena that's really messy into highly structured content that can be stored in the database. So the reason why I bring this up, and the key takeaway here, is that I believe, as you know, the computer scientist in me, the giant nerd in me, I believe that the technical components of algorithms are incredibly important, but that they need to be studied in relation to the social components as well, and in ways through which algorithms interact with mutual social shaping. So that it's fine in my mind for a single journal article to focus on either the technical or the social, but if you're developing a research program that is really looking at the use of algorithms in journalism and society at large, you need to take account of both. And that's what I'll be trying to do with this definition, or with this presentation rather. And to me, a single definition matters less than how you contextualize how you are approaching the study of algorithms. So that way you can make it clear whether you're focusing on the material aspects or the social aspects. All right, so that's algorithms. Now we get to the other part of automation. What is automation? And a very simple definition is that it's any sort of technique, method, or system of operating or controlling some process by highly automatic means, where the goal is to reduce human intervention to a minimum. doesn't necessarily mean that you completely remove a human from the process. Humans are always going to be involved in the process of automation because they still have to design the algorithms at minimum. But the idea is that the procedure can then continue with minimal intervention on the part of a human being. And we can also note that automation in journalism isn't something that is completely novel, isn't completely new. We've had varying amounts of automation since at least the 1970s, where simple weather reports would be automated as well. But I think the key difference here is that modern algorithms are far more sophisticated and have far greater independence than ever before, where they're no longer just helpers, but they're now communicators in their own right. And why should we study this area at all? Well, first and foremost, algorithms and automation are intruding in nearly every aspect of social life today. Not just in journalism, but you see algorithms that are used to determine sentences for criminal offenders and determine whether they should be granted early parole or not based on some assessment of their likelihood for recidivism, right, that they would reoffend and end up back in jail. It's used in pro sports and the minor leagues to identify athletes that are likely to do well, so you want to draft them early. And it can be used in things as simple as determining someone's credit worthiness, which impacts their ability to buy a house, to buy cars, and so on. So in society, algorithms are becoming incredibly, incredibly important, and certainly within journalism too. Before I get to journalism, though, I will note that you both have a lot of optimism around artificial intelligence and algorithms, and a lot of pessimism, right? So algorithms can give us better French fries. It'll make our food taste better. It'll make us happier by consequence. But at the same time, it could lead to a nuclear war. So, oh, God, not so good. But I think right now, people are still trying to come to grasp with the potential implications of artificial intelligence. And so you have people on a lot of different camps, and they have very strong opinions about it, which obviously if you're interested in the sociology of these things, it's fascinating to study. And within journalism in particular, in a lot of sectors, automation is talked about as the future of journalism, that the organizations that will succeed and thrive are those that are able to make good use of algorithms and to employ more sophisticated automation. And we can debate whether that is true or not, but the idea of automation has a lot of symbolic value, a lot of discursive value within journalism now. And today, you see automated journalism already being responsible for tens of thousands of articles each year. So it's already a big deal, and not just in the United States. Certainly, I've been talking to Oscar and hearing about a lot of examples in Norway and Sweden. And it's not just niche publications either, but very large groups like the Associated Press that are making use of this. And this introduces some really important changes to journalism that I would argue can be fundamental to the way we think about journalism, to the way we practice journalism, to the way that people perceive journalism and consume journalism. So the AP has put out a number of guides. They've actually been, the Associated Press, they've actually been at the forefront of automation in many ways. And thankfully, they've been very open about the work that they've done. So if you Google AP Insights, for example, it'll take you to a blog where they regularly talk about these things, and you can download some of the reports that they have up there for free. And this is just one of those reports. And this is an example of how the AP is using algorithms now, where they will use one set of algorithms to look at large bodies of documents and try to pick out what is most interesting in these documents. From there, the algorithm will write a story either by itself or with some human support. And from there, it'll use another set of algorithms to determine what kind of content should we be recommending to what kinds of people. So you're seeing, again, algorithms being employed in multiple steps along the chain. And from there, the algorithms can be used to create one set of content with certain parts of a longer story for your Alexa device, you know. Another set that's going to be much shorter for your Apple Watch, something else that might go to your smart car or to your laptop device. So they'll split it up where there's some platform parting there, where some parts of a story will go to some devices but not others. So the overarching question that I have, or that I'll be touching on with this presentation, focuses on what we don't know about algorithms and automation as they are employed in journalism, and start to think about ways that we can study those things. And here, again, is where I would welcome input from you all, since I expect you are considerably more intelligent than I am, and that's the idea here. So I'm focusing on four main areas of inquiry, which is what I've built this presentation around. The first one just being theories and methods, so how algorithms and automation challenge our scholarly knowledge. The second area being networks and structures, so how they alter social arrangements. You know, the people that are involved in newsrooms, how they see one another, how they see themselves in relation to non-human actants. Processes and practices, so how they impact the core logics that govern journalism and some of its most important activities like fact-checking, interviewing, and so on. And finally, the outputs and products, so how they shape the actual content that we ultimately end up seeing. So those are the four main areas that I'll be focusing on today. So let's start with automation and theory for that first area. And here, the main question that I have is, how do algorithms and automation, in particular their emergence and proliferation, change our understanding of all of these different theories that I think are implicated in this process? And this could be things like agenda setting, could be, you know, gatekeeping that have been well explored, field theory and social worlds that will touch upon sort of the valuation, the cultural capital that is given to particular individuals, particular activities, how it challenges, you know, diffusion theory, the spread of information, and who tend to be seen as opinion leaders in what contexts. So I won't go into each one of these theories, but you're going to see them come up throughout points in this presentation when I get into more concrete things. But what I will note, just at a higher level, is that a lot of the theories in our field tend to assume that, or tend to view humans as the primary communicators, that what algorithms and actants tend to do is be support for human communication, as opposed to communicators themselves. Because now, as we saw, you have algorithms that can go from looking at a body of documents and extracting insights to writing the story to pushing that story out without a human being involved in that process. In effect, an algorithm has become a complete journalist, right? Has become a human being in some ways. A lot of these theories also draw on this idea that we have common and shared understandings of phenomena, largely because you will have a single media, single story, for example, that would have a set of facts that everyone who reads that story would see the exact same set of facts, that the story is not going to be highly personalized such that people have drastically different experiences, even as they think they're looking at the same thing. And And algorithms and automation will change that because there is so much more personalization. And in many ways, the dominant logic there is to shift away from creating publics around an idea and more towards creating individual experiences for people. Yep, exactly. I think there are just important theoretical considerations involved in that. And a lot of theories also assume processes, like gatekeeping, for example, that are only somewhat opaque. You know, with human beings, they may not be able to articulate some of their tacit knowledge, but you're still able to interview them and try to figure out what they're thinking about. So you still get a little bit of a lens into that. But a lot of the algorithms that are employed in journalism operate as fully opaque black boxes in the sense that they are proprietary algorithms with companies that don't want to share that information because they are, it's incredibly valuable for them. And certainly there are examples of open source algorithms, and you do have some companies that are willing to let you peek in with a limited disclosure agreement. But for something like Facebook's newsfeed, you know, good luck looking into something like that. And the other part that I think is actually really important to mention as well is that while you might think, well, why don't you just interview the people who create these algorithms? They can tell you how it works. Oftentimes they can't, actually, because they are adaptive. They are constantly learning. So they can give you some idea about the variables that the algorithm might be attuned to, but they might not be able to fully explain why this beautiful thing that they created is suddenly, you know, shouting really problematic things on Twitter, where it starts to harass people and use very profane language, because don't train algorithms on Twitter. Twitter is not a happy place. So this is Microsoft Research. They did this. I don't know if you're familiar with that example. So this is from one of the Associated Press reports where they will say one issue with using smart machines in journalism is their inability to explain how they make decisions, sort of like black boxes. Sometimes we just don't know why an AI-powered monitoring tool flags a campaign finance document as questionable, or why a mother of two is shown a story about education reform. The answer lies in the millions of correlations these machines can make when they process content. What we do know is that the systems adapt based on consumer use and the data they ingest. In this context, newsrooms can train them by entering quality data, which could include archival content. So what they're saying here is that there are things that we can try to do to make sure that an algorithm will behave and produce something that is quality. But at the end of the day, we have a very limited ability to explain how it's all working because it's just a whole bunch of correlations that we don't really have much control over. So that's what I mean about even the creators of the algorithm sometimes not fully understanding why the things they've created do certain things. The theories that I mentioned are also often ill-equipped to handle the quantity and speed of contemporary algorithmic decision-making and production, such that news today is far less stable. It's more ephemeral, it's more liquid, as Mark Doisa would say, than ever before. So it's constantly changing. And beyond just the theoretical implications that I've described, there's also a lot of interesting legal questions that come up. And my sister's a lawyer. I've always been interested in law, so this is a little nerding moment for me. But who is liable at the end of the day for news content that has been produced completely by an algorithm? Do we give algorithms personhood, legal personhood, and that we end up blaming or making legally liable the technology itself? Or do we still have the liability placed upon the people that created the algorithm, who again may not have full control over what the algorithm is doing? And I think that's really interesting. And same thing applies to invasion of privacy. So it's not just libel. And Yeah, as they continue to gain intelligence, and we've seen rapid developments over the past decade. So as they become smarter and smarter, how does that change the legal calculus? I think that's going to be a fascinating question to see how the courts adjudicate. So we as scholars, I think, need to be examining how power relations, and I'm really interested in power, questions of power, how power relations among different human actors end up being complicated by and through their interaction with non-human actants, and how those tensions end up playing out in highly contested spaces. So, you know, we're talking about metaphysical spaces here where you might have journalists and technicians working more closely than in other metaphysical spaces, how they play out in those highly tense environments. And particularly in a time of precarity, right, where a lot of people are worried about their jobs, might be worried about being replaced by algorithms, might be worried about journalism losing its mission. So I think that's a question that Roy would love to explore as well. And how are certain journalistic activities, certain practices being reimagined and perhaps relocated from being the nexus of the newsroom to being seen as more marginal activities as algorithms continue to proliferate and gain further intelligence? It's a really important question that we need to be asking. And ultimately what... Oh, yeah, question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I also think it's a power struggle between journalists and algorithms,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that the journalists are trying to figure out the algorithms,
mm-hmm.
and they're also trying to fact-check the algorithms,
yep.
because of the lack of transparency.
Mm-hmm.
Because in certain ways, it can be hard to trust the algorithm.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, think about some of the big services like Facebook or...
Mm-hmm.
Here in Norway, there's been this big article about Tidal and how
sure.
they've been manipulating the numbers. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's also important that we figure out ways to get more transparency into
sure.
black boxes.
Yeah, I think that's really important, but I think you also bring up the question of how human beings see themselves in relation to algorithms as perhaps being more civically minded, whereas the algorithms might just be more consumer oriented, that they just care about efficiency. But me as a journalist, I got into this job because I want to help society, you know, those kinds of things. So I do think it brings up questions about how they legitimate their work to outside audiences, but also tell themselves that my job is worthwhile. I'm getting paid crap, but it's still important that I'm here despite these algorithmic actants, because I can do things that they can't, and damn it, journalism needs me right now. You know, that kind of idea. And I think those are questions that relate to power and self-conception that are very important to be considering. Does that touch on the point? Yeah. And touched on this a little earlier, but also how the civic mission of journalism to, you know, help form public opinion. If we touch on the very contested idea of the public sphere, right? To what extent do algorithms and automation make it even harder for us to ever reach the ideal of some sort of public sphere or public spheres for different groups when you have a focus on individualization and datafication, so only counting certain things that we deem to matter. So I think those are all important ideas that we can, that we need to be examining. In terms of methods, what new methods and what revisions to methods do we need to be considering in order to study news algorithms and to study automation? So I think we need to have more just as you were describing, there's been a lot of conceptual work on the idea of black boxes and why they're problematic, but we need more empirical work trying to reverse engineer those black boxes as a way of getting better transparency. Because one way is to ask companies to be more mandated. Ask companies to be more transparent. Another one is to mandate them to be more transparent. A third one is, well, if they're not gonna do what we're asking them to do, and if we're not gonna mandate, then we need to find ways to reverse engineer things ourselves. So as scholars, I think that's something that we can be thinking about. And that requires borrowing methods from other disciplines and doing some methodological innovation of our own within journalism studies. So one idea could just be code audits. So here what you would be doing is actually analyzing the computer code that might be made available through either open source projects that will post their code up on GitHub, or if you manage to strike up a good relationship with a company and they let you look at the code behind their algorithms, to actually see how logics, you know, ideas about how to do things, are actually formalized into computer code, into instructions that a machine can follow. I think that's one way to better understand how the creators of algorithms think about the way that journalism ought to be done, because that's how they try to teach their algorithms, or program their algorithms. And that does require, as a scholar, you to know programming, of course, since you're analyzing code. And it's important to note that there are multiple programming languages out there. You know, algorithms aren't just written in R or in Python or in C or any of these other languages. Oftentimes, you have one algorithm that's written in one language, another algorithm that's written in another, and they actually communicate with each other despite being written in different languages. So, as a researcher, you just need to be attuned to that. But even beyond the code, good programming practice dictates that you should comment your code, which means that you have a set of instructions that you give to the computer, and then you write kind of in the margins, if you will, for a human being who later, or for yourself, later when you go to look at that code again, here's what I was trying to do with this. This is why I did it this way. That's good practice. Coders don't always do it. But you can also include in your code audit an assessment of the comments, so the way that the programmer is thinking about things as well, and what can be intuited from that. But of course, like I said, this is best suited for evaluating open source projects because developers rarely allow access to closed source code. Patent review is actually something that I think we could be doing as well when we want to see how fact-checking algorithms work. If we can't look at the code, we can look at the patents that, you know, these applications that companies and individuals have put forth in order to secure intellectual property rights to their ideas. And with those patents, you actually have to go into quite a bit of detail about the process. So this is another way of understanding the logics that are being imbued into those algorithms. It does require you to understand highly technical and legal terminology, so that can be difficult to do a patent review. But the upside is that information about patents is available online for anyone to see. So if you do a search for fact-checking patents, for example, you would probably get about 45 results. I think that's what I saw a little while back. So 45 different ways of perhaps using software to fact-check information. So you can see how others are thinking about this highly complicated process and trying to teach a computer to do it. But it is unlikely to capture a number of important innovations that are happening in smaller newsrooms that don't want to go through the entire process of patenting their ideas. So again, there's a shortcoming there. Simulation, emulation, and automation. When you're trying to reverse engineer algorithms, sometimes you need to pretend to be different people to see how the information changes based upon the background that you've created for those two people. So a simple example of this might be for you to have two, very basic example, two separate browsing sessions. One where you have been Googling, you know, nationalistic movements, and that is your background. And another one where you've been Googling bunnies and happy people. All right, so these two very distinct histories. And you can sort of see how different public relevance algorithms, things, you know, algorithms that will determine whether you'd be interested in some content but not others, might respond to those histories. And you can start to introduce new variables in a controlled environment, in a controlled simulation, to try to get a sense of what these public or what these different algorithms are factoring into their decision making. So this is one way to reverse engineer. The challenge, of course, is that you have to be able to guess with reasonable accuracy all the different variables it might be taking into account. And it can be very difficult for you to isolate an effect to a particular parameter. So again, this is a methodology that would need to be refined, but these are the sorts of things that we need to be thinking about more and more as scholars.
There is actually a quite famous intervention which a team of mm-hmm. researchers in Sweden did with Spotify, mm-hmm. in which Spotify asked the Swedish Research Council to cancel the funding because they weren't too keen with this method in which they were manipulating with different user accounts to see how the algorithm and the playlists were working.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't cancel the funding.
Good. But it's important work. And if you're studying things like filter bubbles, for example, it's just about one of the few ways that you can really get a better appreciation for how filter bubbles are working. It's to pretend that you have these drastically different backgrounds and see how you end up being sorted into these different groups. So I think we as scholars need to be examining how content analysis techniques can be applied to or must be adjusted to things like code audits and patent reviews, whether we need to think about it in ways that go beyond a traditional content analysis. I think there's some good work that can be done. There's very little work done on mobile apps, actually. Very little research done into mobile apps. And within journalism studies, to be clear. And I think that's because few people have a good grasp on how to access the data on their mobile devices. So you can see it, sure, but how do you extract data from within apps in your mobile device? And that's where using emulators to pretend like you have the phone, but having access to the root level would allow you to basically install malware on your own emulator to extract information and try to capture data in transit. So that might be one way to navigate that issue, but that's something that we need to be, that's a methodology that we need to be exploring a little bit more as scholars. And just exploring the strengths and weaknesses of different tools that can be applied to the study of news algorithms. And I think I'm starting to go a little long, so I'm going to try to move a little faster here. So for the second area, for algorithms and network, there's this idea of the algorithmic assemblage, which is very similar to algorithms as synecdoche, the way Gillespie describes it that I mentioned earlier. And here, the algorithmic assemblage focuses on the institutionally situated computational code, human practices, and normative logics that create, sustain, and signify relationships among people and data through minimally observable semi-autonomous action. You can always count on scholars to really complicate a sentence. I think the journalists in the room are going like, oh god, I need to edit the crap out of that. But I think it's a really valuable concept to get a sense of the larger network around algorithms, but it hasn't been well studied empirically. And by this, I mean, what does the actual network of automated journalism and other augmented algorithmic augmentations actually look like. What are all the different players, the different companies that are involved in the space, and how are they linked to each other? It's a very simple, basic question that hasn't received that much study. If you're thinking about all the visible and invisible intermediaries that are involved, and an example of an invisible intermediary that I think a lot of us can relate to, when you go on the website of a news organization and the article has a video that's embedded on that page, there's a good chance that that news organization outsourced the creation of the video player to some other company that creates video players but might not create them for news organizations. They create them for a larger audience, which means that there are going to have some design considerations in place that are geared to a far more general audience and that news organizations themselves might need to adapt to in order to use that technology on their own page. So this is something that my colleague Josh Braun has explored for a while. In his case, he did a multi-year study of MSNBC during their digital transition and how they had to negotiate with and were hampered by their agreements with these transparent intermediaries, these companies that no one ever thinks about because they're in the middle, they're not visible to us. So who are those intermediaries within the network of automated journalism, both in terms of creating the algorithms and helping to connect them? And I think this is where you could do some in-depth interviews, and if you have access to some code, you can see some of the software dependencies on there in order to start to map out what that network would look like. And as another example from my colleague Josh Braun, this is an example of the network for ad tech. So when you have advertisers that employ technologies to figure out what ads to display to different people, how to know how many people actually saw that ad, clicked on that ad, interacted with that ad, the news organizations that are all involved, look at each one of these tiny little things that you guys can't possibly read if you're in the third row. Those are all different companies. Those are all different players in this system. And we don't have anything like this in the context of automated journalism. And I think that's a good starting point for us to better understand what kinds of actors and actants should we be looking at and studying. How are our existing systems that we have in place actually changing through alterations to or the displacement of social arrangements? So as certain ways of doing things get broken down, as certain editorial hierarchies change, how are they changing as institutionalized structures, evaluations of labor, and sort of what counts as worthwhile activity? How that changes how self-conceptions, as I was describing earlier, and how people see themselves in relation to algorithmic actants, how these things are changing existing systems. Those are all questions that we can empirically study. And some work, to be clear, has been done on this. I don't have time to do a full literature review of everything that has been done, but these are questions that I don't feel have been adequately answered. And I think it's a couple of interesting work that I will mention briefly. Matt Carlson has done a lot of work on automated journalism, and he's talked about when we consider the worth of certain things and the values that are attached to technologies, that if the ideal of journalistic knowledge production is objectivity, then news algorithms are positioned as its apotheosis, meaning that the values that are associated with algorithms and their ability to be neutral kind of position them as this model, right, that we can be looking to, which means that algorithms are being given a lot of power they're thought of so highly that the people who can master algorithms, produce algorithms, those are the most important people in the newsroom, which is something that we need to be questioning and that we probably should be educating people about in terms of the biases that are involved in algorithms. Please.
From what you're presenting, it seems to me that we are really far behind here in Norway, because I don't see that we are very good at using algorithms in the news. So where I see that we are actually using algorithms is if you go to Google News and see how that works, if you go to AdWords to see how that works, if you go to Facebook feed to see that. But it doesn't seem to me like we as news publishers are very advanced algorithm users. When I look into it and I talk to others, it seems that we're at the starting blocks. So I'm a little bit confused because perhaps it's in Norway. It's very easy for me to go to Antibé and ask, how are you doing it? And they don't give me the code. They basically, I have to ask for the code, but I could probably get to look at it and say, okay, you solved that problem that way. And I say, great, I didn't figure that out. So it seems to me that the problems here seems to be more like, how does Google News work? How does Facebook feed work? The problem doesn't seem to be, how does the algorithms within the news production work? But it seems to be a big problem.
I think there's also a disconnect between what algorithms are able to do currently and how they are imagined, so the things that algorithms can do. So oftentimes, people focus on what algorithms can do, its potential, and that's what gives it so much currency in a newsroom, that they start to think that algorithms are how we can solve so many of the problems that we have in journalism. Right now, we're not there yet. Maybe the algorithms that are used in news production are relatively simple. But this is what they will be able to do someday, and this is why we need to be investing in these things. And that's what I mean about the sorts of power that can be granted. But even for things like, you know, the Associated Press, how they can look at thousands of corporate earning reports every single quarter, and it used to be that close to the end of the quarter, as those reports were coming out, that all the journalists would hunker down and go, oh crap, we have to read all these documents, and so on and so forth. When they started using automated insights to mine those documents, pull out the most interesting things and start to automate some of those stories, some of that grunt work, even though it can seem simplistic, for so many people it was, holy crap, we just solved a huge problem that we used to have.
When I look into this, I get the impression that the reason they're hiding it is because their technology is so primitive. Not because it's like advanced and it's big, it's just like, holy shit, is it really that simple and primitive? It's like, it's not very good technology.
But I think
for me it seems like it's an overkill, because if you looked into the big algorithms like Google and Facebook, which are some of the best, that's impressive stuff. With automated insights and the others, it doesn't seem that impressive.
Yeah, and here's where the mythology comes in, though, because the people that are best connected to the, that are most knowledgeable about the work that these companies are able to do right now, tend to be the ones that are most skeptical. However, a lot of the people that are on the outside and they just see that a machine can write articles, holy crap, that's where the mythology comes in, and that's where people start to think that it's going to have, that it has so much currency. And so, in a way, I don't want to call it a bubble, because to be clear, like, bubbles, the idea is that they will pop and there's nothing behind the curtain. But there is this idea that I think is dominant in many newsrooms, that automation can accomplish a lot more than it actually can right now, and that within the next few years, it will be able to do some extremely impressive things. And so it's that mythology that drives the currency from a sociological perspective. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's just that, like, so you look at machine learning and you see the driving cars, and you see recognizing cats and dogs on images, and you recognize text, and all that amazing stuff, and then you get to the text processing, the natural language processing, and it's utter crap. It's like...
Well, because human communication is so incredibly complex.
Improving our database.
Absolutely. But it's still like, seems to me like overkill. But what you're saying is basically making the foundation for the future.
Yeah, making the foundation for the future and just the dominant beliefs that are out there, because people can't see what's happening in the sectors of self-driving cars and, you know, in other sectors. And they see those advancements and they think, well, journalism is almost certainly moving just as quickly. And so you do have a transfer of currency across, or the idea will be transferred across sectors so that more discursive capital is given to something that is not there yet, if that makes sense.
Because you mentioned objectivity and how algorithms potentially can create more objective.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I wanted to ask a question since we have media people here.
Yep.
And they're using algorithms in the news production of this news agency, NTB. Are you thinking about that when you're producing the algorithms, the rules for making these articles about sports or politics? Or is it mainly to make journalism more effective and saving money?
I would say most of the things we're doing now is like it's training. We're learning to walk.
Yeah.
In a way. And we have some really high ambitions. It would take probably between 5 weeks and 20 years to get there. I don't know.
Yep.
We have to start working on this. What we do is like, when it comes to politics, I mean, we did that really simple. Nobody could arrest us in any way. When it comes to soccer, we can make two articles about the same game, so each local newspaper can have their own angle. And that shows that we can easily make less objective journalism in the future, which is, I think it's probably good that we at least can do it. But I mean, everything we work on is with really stupid algorithms. It takes a ton of man hours to work on these algorithms. They are, in a way, they're simple, but it takes like a year to make build up something that works for a small area. But if we weren't working on that, we couldn't do the other thing. We're now working on the project of translating between the two Norwegian languages. And I mean, we made so much progress in like 19 hours after one guy had a good idea, and he just put like 10,000 articles into something, and it came out in another language the next day with less and less mistakes, but we did it again a week later. So it's so it's about we just need to start how to learn to walk, and when we learn to walk, maybe run.
And I think it's interesting that you mentioned making news a little bit less objective, in the sense that you'll have two accounts of the same event but geared at two very different audiences and structured in a different way to promote the local angle. Whereas, at least in the United States, a lot of the discursive power that is given to the idea of automated news is that it will become more objective because you've removed a human being from the equation. There's less thought that is given to the individualization of those stories and how that might impact the notion of objectivity. But this is another way, again, we're talking about discursive power. It's all these ideas, all these values that are attached to automated journalism. It's less about the technology, and that's why I really emphasize the social. But these ideas that it'll be more efficient, it'll be more objective, it could be more transparent, if you can have the algorithm tell you where it got its data from, for example, the sort of the provenance. So that's where, again, that cultural capital will come from. Yes, please.
Well, I share much of your optimism about algorithms. One of our students, a master student, she just completed her dissertation last summer on this issue, the introduction of automated journalism in Norwegian newsrooms. And her conclusion supports much of your thinking. She did interviews with programmers, journalists, editors, including NTB, the Norwegian Telegram Bureau news agency. And her main conclusion is that algorithms at this point, and I'm speaking about last summer when she handed it in, can kind of relieve the journalist for some mundane tasks, but broadly speaking, algorithms and automated news is just in its infancy in Norway.
Yep.
And I have one point that you didn't cover, spurious relationships. I mean, you talked about correlations and reducing uncertainty and so on, but with big data and so on, how can an algorithm, there is still the risk that, you know, it won't, it will miss out on the spurious correlations. Cause and effect, I mean.
Oftentimes, and perhaps you can better answer this question, but oftentimes the journalists, I don't want to say they care less about the cause and effect, but rather they are simply trying to highlight that there might be something here. So with spurious relationships, if you're making a causal claim, that's where spurious relationships would be really problematic, because you can attribute the cause to the wrong thing. But I think a lot of journalists would be willing to say, well, I never made the causal claim. I simply said that these things could be related, and if they're not, then someone else will correct the record, or maybe I'll correct the record myself at some later point in time. So I don't think that a lot of news organizations using algorithms are thinking a whole lot about spurious relationships. Would you say that that's a fair assessment?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is problematic, of course, especially if you're making causal claims. So just to finish and directly to the point that you're making from your student, a lot of journalists are actually seeing automated journalism as a way of ensuring the future of journalism by offloading some of the grunt work, some of the less desirable work, like writing those summaries of corporate earning reports, to free up time for them to focus on investigative pieces, on things that require a more inquisitive mind, or require certain skills that algorithms don't currently possess. And some have argued that algorithms can just create entirely new forms of journalistic labor. People that will oversee the algorithms, that would be tuning the algorithms. So you're introducing new job categories in newsrooms through the introduction of algorithms. Though some still see it as a threat, especially for entry-level work. So if you take away the very simple stories, which is how a lot of young journalists would cut their teeth, you know, by practicing writing those very basic summaries, the high school sports games and everything, that you are essentially making it harder for people to break into journalism because you've taken away that entry point. So those are some of the concerns that scholars have identified. That scholars have found in their interviews with journalists. And you can see, this is from the Associated Press, how they think about all the potential good that can come out of algorithms, that it can attend to those menial tasks to free up journalists to focus on more complex reporting. It can make communication and collaboration among journalists even better. It can allow journalists to sift through these large corpuses of data that they otherwise would never be able to, that it'll make it easier for journalists to better communicate with the people who consume their work, and that it will create just entirely new forms of journalism. So this is what I mean about the discursive power that is given to it, because in many places it's seen as the future, as a way of making journalism so much better. And this is also from the Associated Press. They talk about how the chain of command might change with through the introduction of automation and artificial intelligence. And so they would argue that traditionally you just have reporters who would answer to a desk editor, who would answer to a section editor, who would answer to a copy editor. But now you are starting to introduce the AI that would be working with the reporter, AI that would be working with the desk editor, and still having human supervision. This is how the AP has thought about it. But I think it'll be interesting to see if, as the technology starts to mature and starts to become better, if this order will flip. If instead of it being the AI that helps the reporter, it would be the reporter that helps the AI. And I'd be really curious to see the tensions, how the tensions play out in newsrooms as automation becomes more sophisticated and as other areas of news production become increasingly affected. And so it's not just the simpler menial tasks.
We were talking about this earlier about the opportunity to share. We're doing field work with a larger Swedish local news media company in which they have created a platform which essentially can automate all the editorial news placements of all the articles for nearly 30 titles. But then they enable human editors working as desk editors to manually rearrange based on Crowdtangle and other analytics. So they will look and they will use some gut feeling as well. Mm-hmm. And while overseeing over the shoulder and also doing reconstruction interviews, they made salient that I have the power here to untick the robot. I can make a decision here where I don't allow the robot to interfere with my human decisions. Mm-hmm. Whereas, of course, the data team, centrally organized, can, within the blink of a second, do the opposite. To say, you are no longer allowed to make any manual rearrangements of articles. So, here we definitely have an opportunity to see these tensions play out. And it's a matter of many issues, of course, quality, costs, and...
Evil Rodrigo was instantly thinking about how might they start to use certain design cues to give the impression of control to humans in order to defer more of the control to algorithms but reduce the tension. Those are always design considerations that are in play. So some key concepts and lenses for the scholarly study of those changes. You can look at, you know, social worlds, the work of Howard Becker, interactive interdependencies, boundary objects and trading zones, cultural capital and other things that we can get from field theory, occupational precarity, which Roy is now studying, and Henrik Ornebring and others have been studying for a little bit as well. So I think all of these lenses can add to our understanding of these developments, and I've actually been working on a separate piece that's been working on for a few months now that's trying to tie together different concepts from all of these lenses and frameworks into a more unified theory of understanding socio-technical change in journalism. So look for that within the next 5 years. So some approaches to the study of this, in-depth interviews and field work, examining the discursive construction of those actants and technologically oriented activities and technical actors, surveys of news workers that might assess the value that they accord to different kinds of skills, both by human journalists and non-human journalists, and even just content analyses of trade publications to see how they are talking about the future of journalism and how, you know, keynote speakers at professional conferences factor in technological actants into their visions of the future of journalism. So I've already gone way long, so I don't know if we want to take the break or if I should keep going through it. Does anyone need to use the restroom or just want 2 minutes without hearing my voice?
We could take just a 5-minute
language. Sounds good. I completely understand. Alrighty, I think we can keep going if that's okay with everyone. Then this is just for the second half of the presentation, which is shorter than the first half. And now I'm going to be focusing on automation as it might affect news practices and news processes. And you can easily envision automation being used both on the production side and the consumption side. So you can have automation for natural language generation, for the production of news texts based on some data, for natural language processing, so looking at existing corpora, existing documents, and trying to get some insight out of it. You can see automation being used for automated fact-checking, for automated image recognition, and then on the consumption side, relevance, which is something we're all familiar with, right? Your Googles of the world that will try to figure out what you're most likely to be interested in based on a number of different factors, and tagging algorithms that might just be able to look at a document and attach some information about, like, happy news or other things that would give the reader an indication of what they might find and could allow them to manually sort through to find what they're most interested in. So I had mentioned that Earthquake Bot earlier in the presentation. This is a very, very simple example of natural language generation where you would just have the algorithm look at the U.S. Geological Survey data. The moment that there's a new entry in that database, it'll craft a tweet that will always follow this template. A blank magnitude earthquake occurred blank miles of blank. Here's some additional details about that. So if you look through its Twitter feed, all the tweets look exactly the same. But this is a very simple example of natural language generation. And from there, you have examples that are a little bit more sophisticated. So this is from the Associated Press. It's a sports story. Dylan Tice was hit by a pitch with the bases loaded with one out in the 11th inning, giving the State College Spikes a 9-8 victory over the Brooklyn Cyclones on Wednesday. Denny Hudnicka scored the game-winning run after he reached base on a sacrifice hit, advanced to second on a sacrifice bunt, and then went to third on an out. For a lot of people, they would read this, and until they got to this point down here, that the story was generated by automated insights, they actually would not be able to easily tell this from a story written by a human journalist for these kinds of stories. A lot of studies have actually shown where a group of people would be given a story written by a human being, another group, stories written by automated insights, and it was virtually indistinguishable. So there's been plenty of literature on that. Now, natural language generation requires at least two things. That's going to be a data source. Oops, a question? Yeah?
Yeah, I have a question regarding this kind of journalism.
Yeah.
So, what data is it based on? Who's doing the data on this?
So, in this case, it's going to be a sports story where they have access to things like play-by-play information. So, every time a player steps up to bat, right, it'll say swung and there was a strike. Did not swing, there was a ball, bunted and was able to get on first base. So those are all going to be three separate lines in a database. And from there, it can just look through all those lines and try to figure out when was there a pivotal moment in that game. And the pivotal moment in this case obviously was at the very end in the 11th inning that, what was it, they this person was able to score the run because another player hit a sacrifice bunt, meaning that they hit the ball in a certain way, and this player was out, but this player was able to score the point, was able to make the run. So all it's doing is just going through all those different plays in that game to identify the pivotal moments, and then take the data from those pivotal moments and translate that into a template much like this. And you will have a range of different templates that can be used for a game story like this. And it'll just pick out the best template based on its analysis of the play-by-play data. That's how it would usually work for a story like this. And so natural language generation requires at least two very basic things, the data source, like I just described, and some sort of template that it can feed that that data into. But then you have the algorithm in that middle that is going to be trying to figure out what data sets should I be looking at? What are the pivotal moments in this game or the pivotal information in this report? How should I prioritize that? You know, what information should I put closer to the top? What information can I move a little bit further down in order to create some sort of narrative? And from the available pool of templates, which template would be best suited for this kind of story? So which one should I select? So it'll make all of these decisions, and it will feed out a story much like the one we just looked at. But the key thing to keep in mind here is that the data need to be structured in some way. It can either be well-structured, meaning everything is already as a separate row in a database with clearly labeled variables, or it can be semi-structured where it might be a loose piece of text, but it follows patterns that the algorithm can just extract out by doing simple pattern matching. So the key here is simply to understand that the information needs to be translated into a structured data set at some point in order for it to generate natural language. Some of the challenges that algorithms might not be able to capture the nuance of human communication and to fully contextualize factual information, so to qualify it in a manner that would give the reader a better understanding of what's going on. And based on some of the interviews by Neil Thurman and colleagues, a lot of journalists have also expressed considerable frustration over how the extent to which automated journalism can tell stories as opposed to simply produce reports that follow a template. So that will have a more engaging narrative structure that would make people want to continue reading the story, and that oftentimes the algorithms, by virtue of their reliance on structured data, are very limited as to the kinds of stories that it can tell, so that you end up getting pretty simplistic stories at the end of the day because of the data feeds that they will have access to. But I think natural language generation also raises some really important questions. So who is to determine which data sources are reliable? So for something as simple as sports statistics, that's pretty unambiguous. That can be pretty easy to determine if something is reliable or not. But if you're talking about something like mass shootings, right? That gets a lot tougher when you have to rely on usually data sets collected by activists who may not be able to capture all the mass shootings that actually happen. They may classify something as a mass shooting that might be a bit more disputed. So there's some important epistemological questions there. And if there's conflicting information coming from two different data feeds, how is that resolved? How does it determine which data feed to draw from and which one to ignore? Those are important questions. Now, the question of newsworthiness. How should an algorithm figure out what is most important in a story? That's something that human journalists struggle with all the time, how to prioritize that information. So how can we, or how should we train it to figure out what is most important? And then how to present that. In many ways, automated journalism can circumvent the decision of whether to present the story following a simple inverted pyramid format or maybe structuring it as a Q&A, because it will just do both. But then you still have to figure out which one of these will I be promoting to my reader. And that's where maybe you can look at their past history. If they tended to click more on stories that were Q&As, so they tend to like that format better, so I'm going to present them with this format. But decisions still need to be made about how to present information, which we know from other research impacts how people come to understand and interpret that information. So these are questions that we can try to answer through in-depth interviews with news workers and with technologists as well, and through field work. Then you have natural language processing, which tries to understand human language and translate it to structured language. So let's say we have the example of Roy, who sadly is not here. I want us to see the look on his face. But he really loves Brazil, but is considerably less keen on Argentina, which in my mind, and I understand this is being recorded, is just good taste. there's a big rivalry between Brazil and Argentina, and I'm Brazilian. So from that sentence, unstructured, natural language processing can gather that Roy likes Brazil, Roy likes Argentina less than Brazil. And it can go ahead and enter that information in some structured database in some way. So that's, you know, just a simple example of what's happening there. Natural language processing is also an umbrella term for a number of different things, like named entity recognition, that's a component of natural language processing, part of speech tagging, so what's the verb, what's the noun in the sentence, which can then be used to disambiguate information and figure out in a sentence involving multiple people who's actually saying what in that sentence, what can be attributed to each person. You can have sentiment analysis to figure out if they are saying this in a context where they're saying something is good or if they're indicating that something is bad. So all of these are components of natural language processing. But NLP can be used to generate smaller summaries of full-length stories. This is something that we were talking about earlier. You see this actually on Reddit. Has a lot of bots that I think are fascinating to see, where the bot on Reddit will take the linked news story and try to give you a too long didn't read summary of that. So you can see how different people are trying to get at this challenge of summarizing information, which sometimes you need to do if you want to push it out to multiple platforms where the length expectations are going to be different. So either you could have a human being that is tasked with repackaging a single story for multiple devices, or you can try to employ an algorithm that will automatically do that from one journalist-created news story, or algorithmically created news story. You can also have the algorithms constantly mining competitors' coverage to make sure that you're not missing anything too important that they're covering, or press releases as well, to see what deserves more attention from the journalist. Or if you're talking in the case of really large leaks, like a Panama Papers kind of situation, where you have this massive load of documents, you can be employing algorithms to pick out recurring actors to see how different people might be connected with each other based on this large cache of documents. And simply to flag things that journalists might want to pay closer attention to. So this is an example of more technologically infused journalism, to use some of your terminology, Oscar, where you still have the journalist making sense of a lot of these connections, but the algorithms are really calling attention to phenomena that deserves extra scrutiny. But it raises the questions of, to what extent are these technological affordances, so these abilities, actually being used by news organizations? And why are certain affordances being used but not others? Is it simply a technological limitation where the news organization or a journalist might think that an algorithm isn't ready for this kind of work yet, and it's going to miss important things, and so I'm not going to use it now? Or is it simply that I believe that I have superior judgment than any algorithm could ever have, ergo I don't want to use these affordances? So, you know, it raises questions about whether non-use might be due to epistemological concerns, to cultural tensions within newsrooms, or simply technical limitations. Yes?
My experience is that it's basically a time question. Mm-hmm. Because it takes a lot longer time to write code, to write the article, than to write the article. So, if, for instance, the numbers that we're following every month, that's basically 12 times a year. It doesn't pay off to write a robot to write 12 articles a year. If you write once a week, it might be
worth it.
Today, it would obviously be. And these are the issues here. That it's hard to justify that, saying that, okay, we could save like 1 hour, 2 hours, 8 hours, but if we make this robot, how long can we spend on it? Can we spend 1 day?
Sure.
1 week? 1 month?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that it depends on the kind of story that you're working on and the likelihood that you would do enough of those kinds of stories to merit the investment in developing an algorithm. But even at some organizations where an algorithm might be very beneficial for covering all the high school sports, is it simply the case that the news organization might not want to use that algorithm because they don't want to lose their connection with their community and be seen as not really caring about the community? So they're reluctant to employ that technology because they don't want to alienate the people who buy their papers or who access their content online, if there's a cultural concern there. Or maybe something as simple as, we don't want to flood our readers with these really simple stories about who won the game. We would rather simply do in-depth pieces about why an athlete at a school might be struggling with something, and just have a smaller number of stories, but that we're calling attention to these deeper features that are more consistent with our organizational identity. So that's, I think, different reasons why there might be non-use. And I think it would be interesting to examine the articulations of why some organizations choose to really buy into this and why others wouldn't, if it is just practical concerns or maybe more deeper cultural concerns or epistemological concerns.
I believe it's two basic issues at the time, and the other issue is the repetitiveness, because computer programs are great at repeating again and again, and can do like in 1 second what we would use 10 minutes,
right.
But journalism is not repetitive. Journalism is the unique stuff, the stuff that's extraordinary, and that's the problem to get this balance. So you have some use cases, for instance politics or soccer matches or baseball matches, that you can reuse for each type of match. But the problem is that journalism, if it's an interesting story, it's because it's extraordinary.
I agree.
Computer programs are, this is happening every day or 10,000 times a day or whatever.
I absolutely agree. And I think that's a big reason for use and non-use in certain genres. But as the technology continues to evolve and maybe the algorithms become better suited at mining the extraordinary and then writing a story based on what it mined that might have been missed by a human journalist in a large cachet like the Panama Papers, maybe the equation starts to change in those contexts. And finally, I think it would be interesting to see how both natural language processing and natural language generation are being combined in order to automate the production of a story for multiple different platforms, as we see news being consumed in very different contexts, different devices, and so on. If there's some sort of way to automate it such that you're being able to target people wherever they are, but reducing the man hours required to accomplish that. All of this requires you to give unstructured, like, news is a very unstructured thing. It's a very messy thing. In order for you to use natural language processing, you have to give it some structure, right? And I think, and in order to do that, you have to develop different taxonomies. So by this, I mean that when we design the natural language processing algorithms and we go to insert that information into a database, we have to figure out what are the fields that we're interested in. Are we just interested in picking out, you know, the geography of the story? Are we interested in figuring out just the types of people, you know, types of sources, that if it's government officials and we want to see this person's name, government official, yada yada. You have to give structure to all of this. You have to come up with some sort of taxonomy. And I think it would be interesting, and I haven't seen this be done, to do an empirical analysis of the taxonomies that different news organizations are actually using and how algorithms end up using information from certain taxonomies in generating articles subsequently. And ultimately, the implication, if we talk about repetition, of relying on particular taxonomies, I think those are all interesting questions that we can study as scholars. I have some fact-checking stuff here. Do you want me to go with that as well, Oscar? I spent a lot of time on this. So for the remainder, I have fact-checking to look at, and then I also go into discussion moderation, and I go into news content itself. And I'm already at 4:25, so I'm just wondering if anyone needs to go someplace. I can focus on just one of these areas, or...
Briefly touch on fact-checking for 5 minutes.
Okay.
Then we can round out with people having to leave, and we can also...
Sure.
Some of us can stay...
Yeah, and I can also just answer questions because I've covered a lot of material here. So I'll just skip ahead to different ways that people have tried to approach fact-checking in an automated fashion. So you start off with rumor detection, where you have algorithms that are constantly monitoring social media feeds to see what kinds of knowledge claims are being made that may not be substantiated. And so what the algorithm will do is identify those knowledge claims, which can come in through different articulations, try to identify any stances that are happening there, whether this person's a liar, this is a bad thing, and so on. And then it will try to figure out the veracity of that statement by tying it to either the social media feeds of well-regarded, journalists, trusted people, to see if they've tweeted about it as well. It'll increase the likelihood that this is not a rumor, if they can try to fact-check that against some existing database. So this is an example of rumor detection where Bente, who sadly had to go, has been busted for spreading fake news, said that Sten was fired from his job for rigging the May 17th soccer match with his kids' teachers. So here what a rumor detection algorithm would try to do is simply identify multiple variations of this claim that this person was associated with the spread of misinformation. And then what it might do is simply flag this claim for a journalist to investigate by seeing that a lot of people are referencing this thing. So we need to look at it a bit more closely as journalists and perhaps correct the record, whereas fact-checking organizations. You have truth discovery, which attempts to resolve conflicts in data from multiple sources by trying to estimate the quality of the data source and the quality of the information. So an example might just be that Oscar's article, Mobile News, A Review and Model of Journalism in an Age of Mobile Media, has been cited 171 times. That might be the factual claim there. But one data source might say that, Google Scholar, that it was 173 times. Then you might have Crossref that says it was only 63 times. And so all of a sudden, you have the algorithm trying to figure out which source is best suited for this kind of claim, and it engages in this process of truth discovery. The issue with automated fact-checking is that it works best with highly structured claims. So things that have a small number of linguistic variations and with very specific types of knowledge databases. So things like citation counts, that you have a few databases that are pretty well regarded, and those are trusted sources of information that store information in a pretty unambiguous way. So pretty easy to source the veracity of that claim. But if you have a slightly more complex claim, factual claim, that Oscar Westland has written numerous articles on journalism and mobile technologies that have received a bunch of citations from reputable scientists, then it becomes a lot harder for an algorithm to fact check something like that, because it certainly is suddenly needs to figure out what do we mean by numerous citations. How much is numerous? Is 5 numerous in the context of journalism studies? Is 300 citations numerous? And anything less than that, it's a failed article, right? It needs to make those judgments. Who are a bunch of people? What qualifies an article as being in this particular field or particular area of journalism and mobile technologies? What would we consider to be a reputable scientist? These are all questions that are perhaps a little bit easier for a human fact checker to go through the nuance of the claim and an understanding of the context around academic study to be able to assign a rating for that claim, but that an algorithm would struggle mightily to make sense of the context and all the ambiguity in a sentence like that. And we know that keeping a database of quality sources online is a challenging task because those databases can get quickly outdated, especially when you start to move away from things like citation counts and you go into mass shootings and other phenomena that the databases might be created by activists or nonprofits or people that eventually lose their funding and don't continue to maintain the database. So that can be a challenge to automated fact-checking. You also have automation in terms of identifying deceptive opinions or bots. So, trying to identify reader comments that are actually the work of bot networks intended to make it seem like people are really angry about the coverage of X. So that the news organization might want to reconsider its stance for producing articles like that in the future. or if they want to automate the upvoting of a particular opinion, maybe a highly unpopular opinion, but that you use an army of bots in order to make it seem like there is more support for that idea in a community. So in order to do that, you have algorithms that will engage in pattern detection to simply identify similarities with previous postings, with the likelihood that enough people would use a particular syntactical structure or use particular terminology within a certain period of time apart from one another, how long their account has been, how long ago their account was created, all of these different variables that can go into place to try to figure out if this is in fact a comment by a human being or if it is something from some sort of disinformation. And you also have algorithms used to engage in augmented crowdsourcing for fact-checking. So to gamify processes by assessing the amount and the quality of contributions by a human volunteer, by assigning points to it and trying to create some sort of fun competition, if you will. But having the algorithm figure out who is going to get what content to fact check, which volunteers are going to get what content to fact check, and then to automatically compare the input. So all of that, all those feeds coming from the volunteers, you might have another algorithm that will look for discrepancies in those feeds to say that this is something that multiple volunteers disagreed on as to whether it is a true fact or not true fact. So we need to bring in an expert judge to resolve this conflict, or if it can go ahead and pass it on as something that has been debunked or not. So I think just in the interest of time, again, I will end this part here, and we can take a few minutes just in case anyone has any questions about automation in either fact-checking, in news production, in the development of content, the consumption of content, anything of that nature.
Literally anything. We can just ask you.
Rodrigo, why did you start studying this? What is the meaning of life? How amazing is Norway in a Nutshell going to be on Friday?
Thank you, Rodrigo.
Yeah.
Where do you see the most potential for using automation in news work, journalism work?
Potential?
Yeah, where are you most optimistic that this is really going to be great for journalism?
Mm-hmm. I do think that automation can be really useful for uncovering systematic abuses in society by automating looking through arrest reports, for example, and calling attention to the over-policing of certain communities, for example, like those kinds of social issues. If you can get a data feed that is being constantly updated so it doesn't become the sort of thing that there's one big feature on it and then people don't touch that issue for several months down the line. So I see a lot of potential for using natural language processing to extract abuses and then natural language generation to keep that in the... keep those kinds of stories recurring a lot so that people are being constantly exposed to, here's another example of this community being over-policed, being abused. So in terms of potential, that is one that I certainly see. That is certainly an area that I see a lot of promise in.
That's good, because that's actually a repetitive.
Yeah, exactly. It is repetitive, so I think it's a reasonable expectation. You know, in my mind, I would love to see political stories that go beyond he said, she said, and try to tackle a little bit more meaningfully the policies that are being proposed and have some sort of natural language processing that would look at candidates' proposals, candidates' voting histories, all of these things to produce stories that are more policy-oriented, but that is considerably more complex. So to me, that's what I would really love to see it go. But I think at the intermediate level, having just recurring stories that are repetitive but keep our attention focused on injustice is something that would have a lot of potential. Yeah.
It's opened my eyes and opened my mind to a lot of things that I haven't clearly given enough thought to.
Sure.
It's been really good. Just leading on from that point, which I think is so interesting, this kind of automation can be used in the interests of social justice. But I think, generally speaking, what we're seeing is a distancing or a like a further stretching of news and information. You know, as journalists, you know, I think people see they have two roles. You know, one is to do that important analytical and interpretive work, and also, you know, just the delivery of information. Do you see a kind of stretching and a further differentiation between those two things?
I think as a whole, that journalism has been moving more towards a service model where it's less just the production of something that is new, but rather creating something that is of value to communities, and that could just be linking them to information. So it's not necessarily that they're a news outlet, they are an information outlet that can understand what their readers are most interested in and would be most affected by, and find ways to better link them to resources for helping them deal with everyday issues. So if anything, even just outside of automation, I see news and information coming closer, if anything, because of this move towards a service model. And I think automation would just continue that convergence. That's how I see things playing out, at least.
That's great. Yeah.
Rodrigo, we have some industry representatives here, and this may come right up in the face, and you need to think about this afterwards a bit, but we've been discussing some different avenues for our collaborations in Sweden, and just imagine if we were to set up a collaboration with some of the Norwegian industry representatives, and you were to access some of the data, the code or the analytics to kind of assist them in further developing their automated journalism analytics to develop better services. What would you envision would be most interesting or helpful in terms of data sharing to help develop things for the Norwegian media industry? What would be...
Sure. So, I certainly think that it would be wonderful to peer into the so-called black box to see the kinds of algorithms that are being used. And I think what we could contribute back to that would be precisely to identify some of the opportunities based on our other research that are may not yet have been either considered or followed through on. So any ability to allow us to see how you are trying to turn your vision for what journalism should be and the way that journalism should be practiced into code and formalizing that process, I think would be really, really helpful for us as researchers, and would also give us the opportunity to give back to industry as well. So if there's any sort of willingness to provide that level of access, I certainly would be interested, and I think I can extend that to we certainly would be interested.
Yeah, we have talking to different universities already. We've been working on the humongous project on automation of fact-checking. We didn't get funding for it. We tried to get funding for the university in Trondheim for a really ambitious project. It would be the biggest project in the world if we had. didn't get the funding though. So it's, came to that. But it's, in a way, what we're doing with the automation of article production is that we are sort of teaching algorithms, or we're making algorithms that can make the same things as those who went to the journalism academies and learned to do.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
And we can see that the interest for traditional journalistic stories is not at the same level as it was some time back. So I think we need to, I don't know this, but I think we need to sort of to split this up in a way. We need to give people that kind of information they actually need, so they don't have to spend so much time reading all those papers to get the little piece of information.
Absolutely.
So where we're heading now is like to go into if we can structure the articles more, so we can split it up. Circa the best thing that happened to news industry for ever in a way, and we need to use the knowledge they got before they went bankrupt.
Yeah, which
and work on that and see how we can sort of split up everything. And, and again, sort of make the machines. First, we have to unteach the students coming from the universities what you've taught them to do. I've said this many times. But we need to use the knowledge they had before they went into the university, because then they're
trained in a very particular way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we sort of have to work on the same way with algorithms, sort of to split this up in some way and make sure that people won't be bothered with information they don't need.
Mm-hmm.
And how we should do this, I have no idea, but I know that we've been on the wrong track for too long.
So I think the Circa example is fantastic. I'm so distraught that it did not work out for them. But I'd be curious to see how your organization, for example, would be thinking about structuring content in the way that Circa did, some of the taxonomies that you would be using.
Well, for a news agency, it's obvious that we should do that. I mean, we have been writing the same story 6 times.
Absolutely.
It's in small changes. I think it's really fantastic that they can do it.
Yeah.
And I think every article is a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
I can only see a lot of letters.
Sure. Yep.
So how we can... I would be interested in working with, universities, researchers on this. Also. But I mean, you have... Please come to the news agency in Norway and look into what we're doing. It's... there are no secrets, as Anders said. It's like it's not very impressive coding. It's just a lot of hard work.
Yeah,
which is the first step on the wrong on the wrong path.
Absolutely. I've certainly gotten the impression that news organizations in Scandinavia are a lot more open than news organizations in the United States. I think the AP has been pretty open.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But there's certainly more of an exception than the rule. So it's just really nice to see that there's such a willingness to engage in collaborations here between industry and academia.
I guess the openness, especially in Norway and Sweden, has been a part of... Well, that's one of the reasons that we have improved faster than in other countries.
Absolutely.
But how we can get the universities to be a part of this, of the progress, of the way we develop journalism, I can't see that. Because it's a gap between what you're working on in universities and what you're working on in real life, and that's
how so?
Pardon?
How so? The gap, is it that the questions we're interested in are simply not as applicable, or
most of the universities are too much focused on the old days and.
I see.
Thinking about the way they thought maybe 20 years ago.
Sure.
that's been changing for a long time. It's like, I mean, I've been hiring journalists for the last 15, 18 years, and I find more interesting people without a journalism school background than with journalism school background. And that's, it's a bit scary.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the theme for today, but it's the, it's reality.
Again, they're conversations that we should be having.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But representing the digital journalism research group, we are, I can say that we're very keen on reducing that gap and engaging more in connections with you industry representatives here in Norway, similar that you've done with NTNU. And engaging dialogue and how we can learn from each other. And I think this is one starting point towards such ambitions.
I can only speak for myself. I'm from a small organization, so I'm the only one doing computer journalism. But I was here in August, and the August before that, when Harald Omdahl was one of your teachers, and I did just a short introduction about how it was working in a small startup journalism. I can come here and show my code, it's no problem. I'm trying to structure it, so I'm trying to make an example that everyone can see, so just simplify the stuff I'm doing. I say not the most advanced stuff, but this is how you build a simple robot journalism, so I'm trying to write that now, so just saying that this is the basic stuff, and then you can build from that. So I'm all for sharing that. I don't think I will impress you in any way, because when you boil it down, it's just like the hard work now is trying to figure what works and keep all the stuff that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And that's the main innovation here. It's actually skipping all the parts that we tried that, it didn't work, we tried that, it didn't work, we tried that, it didn't work. That might work in 5 years, that might work in 6 months. And that's where I waste my time.
Sure, but I think it's also really important to share all those failures so that way other people don't repeat those experiences, right? I think sometimes we focus so much on what works and we ignore at least discussing why certain things didn't work when we thought they might have. And that way we can inform people about don't waste your time on this. I think that's really important as well.
Transforming experiential learning into the curious learning. We're quite good at that in the Scandinavian context, sharing with each other among the media companies.
So, as I can say, if you want to see what I've done, I can. I can't participate in a program that requires me to stay for a long period.
Oh, totally.
But if it's to come here and talk for an hour or sometimes, that's no problem.
Sharing the code sheet, participating in an interview, and seeing this young man doing some magic with the code sheet, analyzing it, and returning some feedback.
Because I'm quite eager that the journalists that are educated actually go out and do stuff. But I remember back in 2009, there was a news story about none of the students that was here when I was at Molde wanted to work in an online news site. That was back in 2009. It was like,
that's ridiculous. Yeah. That's crazy.
I was actually called there saying, we don't need you in the press because we have 20-year-old students. They wanted to work in the paper, not online. It's like 9 years ago. It sounds a long time ago, but that's not long.
That's not.
It's scary. So I'm all for if people are getting interested in being computer in journalism, that would be great because there are there become some more, but it's not many just in Norway yet. It's perhaps 15, and that's great because it was 9 years ago.
Yeah, at UMass, my home institution, we still have a few students that want to go into newspapers, but we try to get them to broaden their horizons. And our curriculum really focuses on digital news production. I teach a class called Data-Driven Storytelling, where it's all about teaching them how to analyze data sets, how to visualize information for, you know, interactive devices. It's very much focusing on you know, so the more recent developments in journalism. I think that's really important, because if we want to see journalism transform into something that can be more useful to citizens, then we need to be training the people who can think about those things in ways that we can't ourselves, by at least giving them some basic skills and the intellectual curiosity to experiment and not be, and be willing to fail. Yeah.
And scholars like Rodrigo and Lisa and others will also participate more in our educational program as guests, being here for a week, for a few days, as we're establishing such a program, but also doing online lecturing and participating in programs in that way.
Yeah.
But anyhow, that's
good to see some new faces at the university.
Yeah, there have been some recent changes of impact. I think the head of the department is really trying to fix the gap. There have been huge gaps for years, but some initiatives at least to try to do something like this.
I'll also say that for that data-driven storytelling class that I teach, I've created a whole bunch of videos on how to do data journalism, and my goal is to eventually release it out to the public, just completely open access. So if you have any interns or anyone who maybe doesn't come into the newsroom prepared and you think could benefit from something like that, I'd be happy to share the videos with you all just as something that can help them along too. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you all.
Thank you.